This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, the 13th of April, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll take a look at the debate over Iran and its nuclear energy program. And after a two-day strike, subterranean train workers in Argentina restore service through next week. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Eric Klein with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. In Chad, rebel forces fought with government troops this morning in the capital city of N'Djamena. This has prompted the government of President Idriss Deby to issue a declaration that his troops are in complete control of the capital. The president accuses neighboring Sudan of backing the rebel forces. Deby himself came to power after launching a rebel attack from Sudan in 1990. In Nepal, civil unrest continues into its eighth day, with no signs of letting up. Police today opened fire on lawyers demonstrating in downtown Kathmandu and arrested at least 70. Another 20 lawyers were injured, four by gunfire and others by police batons. Although the royalist government lifted the daytime curfew yesterday and restored cellular phone service today, new legal restrictions prohibit criticism of the king, his security forces, and his government. As PC Doobie reports from Kathmandu, journalists have been specifically targeted by the police during the ongoing unrest.
A total of 186 journalists have been arrested in the past 8 days. Most are members of the Federation of Nepali Journalists, FNJ, the country's smallest professional fraternity. On Wednesday alone, police arrested some 75 journalists in various parts of the country, including 29 in Kathmandu. Over 300 journalists have sustained baton injuries in attacks by security forces. Mahendra Bista, General Secretary of the FNJ, sounds pessimistic about the current scenario of media freedom.
Yeah, it's a very, very bad deteriorating. No chance to improve, yeah?
A ban has now been slapped on media criticism of the royal family. Punishment for violating the ban can include the cancellation of the press accreditation of the concerned journalist and even a sentence of up to a year in jail. Bista again.
We have no option to protest.
From Kathmandu, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio.
The government of Pakistan deployed troops to some areas of Karachi today after street violence that erupted in the wake of a massive double suicide attack on Tuesday. Masroor Hausin reports.
Riots have gripped the large metropolis for 3 days as angry mobs blame the provincial government for failing to maintain security. 57 people died and over 100 were injured after two suicide attacks at a religious congregation in celebration of the birth of Prophet Muhammad. Funerals were held today for three leaders of Sunni Tehreek, a right-wing organization opposed to President Musharraf's secular policies. The Sunni Tehreek has given an ultimatum of 48 hours to the provincial government to take action against officials responsible for the security lapse. Meanwhile, Mutahida Majlis-e-Amal, an alliance of six religious parties, announced to observe a countrywide day of protest on Friday. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
A British Royal Air Force lieutenant was sentenced to 8 months in jail today after being found guilty by a court-martial of failure to comply with lawful orders to serve in Iraq. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
In his defense, Flight Lieutenant Malcolm Kendall Smith likened the invasion of Iraq to a Nazi war crime. He told the military hearing he refused to serve in Basra, Iraq last July because he didn't want to be complicit with an act of aggression contrary to international law. He also refused to take part in training and equipment fitting prior to the deployment because he said he believed these were preparatory acts which were equally criminal as the act itself. But a Royal Air Force panel ruled against him today. He'll now serve an 8-month prison sentence and be dismissed from the service. The legality of the invasion of Iraq was not examined during the hearing. It was found to be irrelevant because at the time of the charges, the court said the presence of coalition forces in Iraq was legal because they were there at the request of the country's democratically elected government. Flight Lieutenant Malcolm Kendall Smith plans to appeal the conviction and the sentence. He says he still believes what he called the US's imperial campaign of military conquest was in direct conflict with his duties. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Mexico's Environmental Protection Agency, SEMARNAT, says it has found illegal plots of Monsanto's genetically modified cotton. Article 119 of Mexico's biosecurity law prohibits the cultivation of GMOs without authorization. Although the biotech company has permits to plant genetically modified crops in parts of Sonora, the recently discovered illegal GM cotton fields amount to a total of 250 acres. The case has been handed over to the Secretary of Agriculture and to federal prosecutors for investigation. I'm Eric Klein, sitting in for Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
International Atomic Energy Agency Director Mohammad Al-Baradei is conducting talks in Tehran over their nuclear program. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says he will maintain his nuclear ambitions for a peaceful energy program. Meanwhile, analysts in the United States say the U.S. must alter its dealings with Iran and engage in direct negotiations. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Mohammad Al-Baradei's trip to Iran was planned. But for the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the circumstances have made this trip crucial.
More active cooperation between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the agency with a view to move forward on clarifying remaining outstanding issues.
Iran announced 2 days ago that they enriched low-level uranium. At today's meeting, Iran told Al-Baradei they will continue to meet with the IAEA in the coming weeks, but will continue their uranium enrichment process. Although Iran is able to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes as a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the secrecy of parts of the program has alarmed the international community. The United States and the European Union announced that they want to impose sanctions on Iran. In Congress, two resolutions, one in the House and one in the Senate, introduced this year, urge sanctions as well. But China and Russia, both voting members on the United Nations Security Council, have opposed the move in the past because of national interests there. But with Iran's new development, they could ease their opposition. Chinese representatives are traveling to Iran tomorrow. Recent news reports have revealed that the United States is discussing military attacks and possibly nuclear strikes on Iran. Joe Serencioni is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
What I fear is that this administration is strategically exhausted, that they haven't recognized that their vision has failed as it crumbles around them, and they're still on a regime elimination view of how you solve these problems. What I have heard stories of senior officials favoring the military option with Iran, and not because it would just overthrow the nuclear program, but it would accomplish their larger aim, which is to get rid of the regime.
Lawrence Scheinman is a distinguished professor at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies and was responsible for nonproliferation and regional arms control during the Clinton administration. He just returned from a trip to Vienna where he spoke with members of the IAEA.
Even if they're not carried out, the continuous threat to impose a nuclear solution, I mean a military solution on the problem, on the nuclear problem, could very well lead to rallying around the flag, essentially, and bringing groups that otherwise would like to see change take place in Iran to come in behind this rather aggressive-looking regime.
Both experts say that the U.S. has not involved itself completely in the diplomatic process. Again, Lawrence Scheinman.
I think that's a big mistake, that we really should be engaging in a dialogue with the Iranians. What are your problems? What are your agenda issues? Where can we find common ground?
And Joe Serencioni.
The administration has to recognize that its policy on Iran has been a complete failure, that Iran's program has accelerated in the past 5 years, not diminished. Most of the progress Iran has made on its nuclear program has taken place in the last 5 years. And it's been a direct result of a policy that has been all stick and no talk. We've got to change that policy. We have to open up direct negotiations with the Iranians. That's why you're hearing an increased number of experts in the U.S. say this. All our allies are saying this.
And Lawrence Scheinman said there are ways to deal with Iran that aren't even being reviewed within the administration.
There are two enrichment programs in the world today. One is Urenco, which involves three countries. And no one country has the right to take any decision without the concurrence of the other two. So that might be one model that could be considered for Iran. The other one is the so-called Eurodif model, in which there's a central holder of the technology that brings in partners that cooperate with the technology holder.
The U.S. and Iran have talks scheduled for this weekend over cooperation in Iraq. Nuclear issues are expected to be avoided. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Washington Post has published a report stating that President Bush received intelligence information on May 29, 2003, that the trailers in Iraq, previously treated as key evidence, were not part of a weapons of mass destruction program. Now, a number of former generals are demanding the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, but a White House representative announced today that Rumsfeld is performing an excellent service to his country. Anastasia Genetstitska has more. From Washington, D.C.
A group of trailers in Iraq that, according to the White House, were the mobile labs for creating biological weapons, turned out to hold weather forecasting tools instead. The classified CIA report containing this information was sent to the president right after the attack on Iraq was launched in March 2003. The Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, stated that the team's findings had not been ignored and had been incorporated into the Iraq Survey Group's report. Nevertheless, the administration's conclusion has been that Iraq does have WMDs, and these trailers were cited as the main evidence. Victoria Sampson, research analyst on weapons systems at the Center for Defense Information.
Again, it seems that this administration was insistent on only hearing what it wanted to hear and only believing what it wanted to believe. And the idea that the labs were meant to produce bioweapons fit into their idea as to what could actually happen. And they ran right over any evidence to the contrary. It's possible they deliberately ignored it. It's possible that the intelligence agencies involved weren't forceful enough in writing it. It's possible that the intelligence was confusing on this. I doubt it.
Following this information, several former high-ranking officers from the Army and Marines have called on Defense Secretary Rumsfeld to step down because of his handling of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. They accuse Rumsfeld and other civilian officials of disregarding the opinions of experienced officers in the days before the 2003 invasion. Retired Major General John Batiste said in an interview that the military needs a fresh start in its civilian leadership. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan stated today that the president has no intentions of asking Donald Rumsfeld to resign.
The president believes Secretary Rumsfeld is doing a very fine job during a challenging period in our nation's history. The secretary has led the Department of Defense during two wars, wars that resulted in the liberation of 25 million people in Afghanistan and 25 million people in Iraq.
Victoria Sampson also says it is highly unlikely that Rumsfeld will be asked to resign, since President Bush puts a big emphasis on loyalty to the members of his team. According to her, the new evidence adds to the poor view of the U.S. intelligence gathering.
It just adds on to a large body of evidence that the United States did not have a good basis for going into Iraq. And it hurts our credibility in regards to any other intelligence prognostications that we make. The case in point now is Iran. The big question is, will Iran be able to make nuclear weapons soon? And if the United States comes out and says, well, our intelligence agencies say, yes, they will, then our credibility is called into question. It's dealt us a real death blow in the international arena.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska in Washington, D.C.
The West Bank city of Nablus has been invaded by the Israeli army on a daily basis for the past 10 days. The Israeli army says it is searching for wanted Palestinian resistance fighters. But as FSRN's Manar Jabrin reports from Bethlehem, aside from the residents that have been killed or injured, the army has also arrested young Palestinian girls.
The West Bank city of Nablus and nearby refugee camps are still under daily invasions, during which the Israeli army arrested dozens of youths. In one instance, the soldiers used a two-room apartment on the eighth floor of the Al-Sharif building as sniper's nest. They took 15 people captive and forced them to remain seated on the floor for 2 days. The captives were between 3 and 70 years old. The army refused to allow medical teams access to the families and prevented any outside communication. One child, however, managed to speak with Dr. Ghassan Hamdan, head of medical relief service, through the door and said that they had had nothing to eat. The Geneva Convention of Human Rights was again violated by the Israelis when their soldiers arrested girls and school children. The army arrested 7 young women from the area around Nablus city. 2 of the families said the girls were beaten in the street and stripped naked during their arrest. They were taken in military jeeps to unknown locations. One parent of an arrestee who asked not to be identified described her daughter's experience.
The soldiers asked me to search her. I started to search her and I found nothing on her. Then they ordered her to accompany them, and I went to go with them, but they told my husband to take me back inside. When I refused, they threatened to shoot me. Then they beat her and put her inside the armored jeep after they had handcuffed and blindfolded her.
The Israeli army arrested children in Nablus city and attacked members of the Palestinian medical relief teams. Majdi Shilla, a local union activist, says the army attacked Dr. Ghassan Hamdan and Firas Al-Bakri of the Palestinian Medical Relief Committees and arrested ordinary school children and university students during the incursions.
A lot of arrests are carried out of youth aged between 16 to 20 years old. For most of them, we had never heard before that they were wanted or activists. In one area, the army surrounded a building and arrested 8 university students. During these operations, the army attacked a journalist, Dr. Ghassan Hamdan, and the paramedic Firas Al-Bakri. The army withdrew from the area half an hour later.
Israeli army intensified its attacks against the Palestinians during last week, killing 19. 95 were injured and 125 were arrested in 1 week, including 5 who were killed in Nablus city during the last 10 days. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Bethlehem, Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
Authorities in the country of Georgia say that they averted a crisis when they opened fire on prisoners during a jailbreak, which left 7 dead and 24 wounded. But as Deborah Wild reports, prisoners, their families, and attorneys tell a very different story.
Saskia Kaftaradze, the Minister of Justice.
That day we faced riot in the prison number 5 and prison number 1. And the threat was real and the threat was imminent that about 4,000 people could have escaped because inmates broke out the doors. They came out to the corridors. They were in the yard.
Saskia Kaftaradze claims that prison authorities did everything to avoid bloodshed. He says they spent an hour warning the inmates, hosing them down with water and shooting rubber bullets to force them back into their cells. The warnings, so Kaftaradze, were ignored, and thus the special police unit opened fire. A version others who were present that night cannot confirm, like the government-appointed public defender. Prisoners, their relatives, lawyers, human rights advocates and other NGOs tell a different story of what happened that night. Koka Gonzadze, parliamentarian for the New Rights Party and member of the Human Rights Committee, visited prison number 5 a few days after the incident.
Most prisoners were very scared to talk, but they've said that everything started when head of the penitentiary, Bako Akielia, accompanied by members of the special police unit, entered the prison hospital, a building next to prison number 5, where they insulted and beat up inmates. When prisoners in the other building heard the screams, they reacted by banging their metal cutlery. From there, it grew into a riot.
Gonzadze doubts, and so do others, that the prisoners would have been able to break the heavy cell doors by themselves. He believes the administration opened them. Whether that could have happened before or after the special police unit started firing is unclear. Even the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is concerned about the different accounts and is asking for an independent and public investigation. The opposition is demanding the dismissal of the head of penitentiary, Bacho Akhalaya. Since his appointment in December, there have been numerous accounts of Akhalaya going on nightly sprees to assault prisoners. And this is not the first time inmates have revolted. The government argues the revolts are the result of an organized crime gang, the so-called thieves-in-law, fighting the ongoing penitentiary reforms. The thieves-in-law exercise control behind bars and make money doing so. Pater Saakashvili, member of the Republican Party, knows the system well. He served for 1.5 years as deputy head of penitentiary when Mikhail Saakashvili became Minister of Justice in 2001.
The authorities are not ridding the world of the thieves in law. They want to use a system for themselves. Their main goal is to take control over the things that the thieves in law control and take the money for themselves. The government needs the money.
In order to obtain even basic commodities like food, fresh clothes, or receive family members, inmates have to pay the prison administration, Saakashvili explains. Since the last revolt, these prices have doubled, so have the prices for procedural agreements with the prosecution, as someone from the prison administration has told Saakashvili. Thus, he believes the abuse of inmates by prison authorities and even the resulting armed clashes are part of a calculated plan. And more prisoners mean more money. In the beginning of the year, the government announced a policy of zero tolerance even against petty crime, and thus ensuring a fresh flow of future inmates. Deborah Wild for Free Speech Radio News, Tbilisi, Georgia.
Subterranean train workers in Buenos Aires have halted a 2-day strike in Argentina's capital city. Service has been restored through next week when fresh negotiations between union leaders and the labor minister will once again try to find a solution to a serious labor conflict. FSRN's Matt Goldin reports from Buenos Aires.
Yesterday, the workers of the 5 lines of subway joined the strike, supporting the subcontractor workers' demands. The disruption of the subway service has caused traffic delays and large queues at bus stops in the Argentine capital. The government, with the direct order of the Interior Minister, sent the special police to one of the subway stations, where the workers were on strike, and evicted the workers violently. In the eviction, 10 workers were detained by the police. The Interior Minister, Aníbal Fernández, justified the repression.
Our job is to collaborate with people. This is a democratic state that respects human rights, that respects the right to petition the authorities. But there's a limit. At some point, we have the obligation to put things in order. We have to ask people to stop and think. And if they don't want to leave, we have to remove them by force.
The subcontractor workers' demands started 1 year ago with multiple meetings in the labor ministry, but the workers never have a positive answer to their requests. Jorge Méndez is one of the delegates who were detained yesterday by the police.
We don't have any answers in terms of the demands we're making. I'm one of the ones who's been arrested, and they've started my court processing. The methodology that this government is using is to carry out a judicial process for protesting workers. We'll take it up in our assembly and decide what's next in this conflict.
Metrovías, the private firm which runs the subway lines, tried yesterday at the end of the day to run one of the lines, but the workers blocked the station one more time. Today, the workers suspended the strike until next week, when they will meet the labor minister, where they will try to achieve an agreement. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
As Peruvians await the final count of votes from Sunday's presidential elections, current President Alejandro Toledo was in Washington, D.C. to witness the signing of the U.S.-Peru Trade Promotion Agreement by Peru's Trade Minister and U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman. Peru's parliament and the U.S. Congress must approve the deal before it can be implemented. The bilateral agreement is one of many the U.S. is looking to make in the aftermath of the failure of the Free Trade Area of the Americas talks. But the future of the trade deal is uncertain in this election year in both countries. FSRN correspondent Christy Lee Pumayrera is in Lima, Peru, and files this report with Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
We cannot fall. And the easy populism that perhaps is very profitable politically, but you don't reduce poverty by playing with words.
Although outgoing Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo has signed a free trade agreement with the U.S., Toledo's party received little support during congressional elections this week, confirming his consistently low ratings during his presidency and raising doubts about the legitimacy of the move to sign right now. Peruvians like Adelinda Nevada question his timing.
He's gone up north, taking advantage of the fact that right now we're in the middle of the confusion of the elections. He's supposed to be finishing his presidency, and instead, he takes the opportunity to go and do this. And let me tell you, we Lima do not approve of what Toledo is doing.
Adelina Nevada is a working mother who was illegally fired along with many other public workers in 1996 due to a lack of governmental labor protections. Many workers' rights activists say that already weak protections will decline under the Free Trade Agreement, or TLC by its Spanish initials. Union leader Susan Portocarrero says a bad situation for women workers will only get worse.
Currently, our compañeras in the agriculture industry, which right now are a majority of working women in our union, these workers aren't given maternity rights. In many cases, we see that the companies subtly communicate that getting pregnant is not permitted while working there. It's not explicit, but if you get pregnant, in many cases, you're fired.
Proponents of the trade agreement point to the economic benefits that other countries have enjoyed under similar agreements. One security guard who sells books on the side to support his family says the only way Peru can get ahead is to promote foreign investment. He points to the example of Chile, which is cited by many as a model for free trade success, after implementing an accord with the U.S. in 2004. He asked that his name not be used.
And what then? The country is supposed to starve to death? Look at where we are. Chile, which has no resources, is doing better than us. We have coastal, Andean, and tropical land, and we have nothing. We're in poverty.
But some say this is a false comparison because the specific situation of Peru differs from Chile. Samuel Zegarra is a miner and an organizer in the National Workers' Federation of Peru, which also represents workers in fishing, oil industry, agriculture, and other trades across Peru.
We find that labor policy in Chile is different. The government provides protection for workers. Miners are backed up by Chile's own constitution. There are laws put in place by the government, and business owners must respect workers' rights. Here in Peru, that's not the case at all. We are totally vulnerable and unprotected.
Specific labor standards requested by the Peruvian government were rejected during negotiations with the U.S., says Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch, a U.S.-based group critical of corporate globalization. Wallach says that lack of labor protections and the fact that this is an election year in the U.S. puts the trade agreement on thin ice.
Unlike agreements like the Singapore or Australia agreements, very prominent Democrats who have supported those other FTAs have been very clear that the Bush administration must go back and renegotiate those provisions in the Peru agreement, or the agreement is not going to be acceptable.
Both the U.S. Congress and Peruvian Parliament must ratify the trade pact. Hoping to stop that, Peruvian social justice groups have organized mass demonstrations demanding a public referendum on the pact. As the final votes are counted in the current presidential race in Peru, the business-backed candidate Lourdes Flores has fallen behind and may not make it to the runoff round. Foreign investors are beginning to support the likely second-place candidate, Alan Garcia, in order to defeat the leading populist candidate, Ollanta Humala, who has denounced the trade pact. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christy Lipuma Herrera with Darby Hickey. Special thanks to Lorena Carpio for her help on this report.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jay Padgett-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. You can get archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary by going to our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.